The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
So the Biloxi River is pretty much gone dry, this drought. What's cool is about our river is what you'll find in the river. Sweep a little bit of the dirt and dust away, and this is what you'll find. Dinosaur tracks. You see the claw marks. Pretty good size. Theropod. These are awesome, awesome tracks. And these are normally underwater, so you don't usually get to see these.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, it's another great find. I mean, we're experiencing unbelievable weather, right? And as I was just sharing a moment ago, rivers and water supplies like Lake Mead, they're shrinking, they're diminishing. What you just heard there was a paleontologist. They've discovered prints of a dinosaur that stood about 15 feet, weighed 7 tons, roamed the area in Texas about 113 million years ago. Those tracks that he was excavating or exploring, they just emerged in recent weeks as the a river there in Glen Rose, Texas, was drying up. I believe it's the Biloxi River. So an amazing thing. I mean, we're hearing all of these reports. I mean, if you live in the southwestern part of the country, my heart goes out to you because you're enduring one of the longest droughts that we have seen in a long time. Parts of Texas, hey, congratulations to you. We've been praying for rain. They got the first rains that they've seen in 3 months earlier this week, but not the entire state. The ground was so hard from lack of water. It's been so baked in the sun that it couldn't even absorb the 9 inches of rain that fell around the Dallas area. And if you saw any of the footage, flooding ensued. And again, that's the exception. The levels on Lake Mead, and I this is what's kind of started my intrigue. And as I continue to watch those levels drop, I mean, Mead is dropping. They just found another body. They're still dropping. The Colorado River, which feeds it, some are saying is now on the verge of collapse. In fact, the federal government has said that it's going to step in. They're actually going to step in. They're going to impose limits on how much the states and Mexico can use. You know, they depend on the water for quenching not just the thirst of, you know, tens of millions of people, but for agriculture and so many other things. The states weren't supposed to have this. I know we talked about this compact in the past where the states were supposed to have reached an agreement on water reduction by now. They haven't done it, so federal government may have to step in, but it's not just the Southwest either. You know, I often watch international news and parts of England, man, they're experiencing drought right now. It is scorching over there. It's not just the U.S. Europe is facing the worst drought, they say, in 500 years. 500 years. So it raises questions to me. What's going on? You know, you hear a lot of talk about climate change. You know, we have the Inflation Reduction Act. Billions of dollars are going to go to going green in that thing. Is it necessary? Or is this all part of the cycle of life, of the planet? I had the opportunity to sail down the Danube River, which is a beautiful river. It's on the, and that is in crisis now too. Rhine and Po, they're all dangerously low levels. Businesses in Germany who depend on the Rhine for transporting goods from one place to another, it's gotten to the point where barges are stuck. That's going to affect supply chain for certain people, you know. And in fact, I was sharing with you right before the break, sunken Nazi ships are being exposed on the Rhine. There are things called famine stones. Maggie and my producer Tom and I were talking about this the other morning. Maggie said, what's famine stones? These are stones that are now being exposed along European rivers, and they're marked with lines. They're also marked with messages. And they essentially say that if the water reaches this level, you're in trouble. You're done for. So from Europe to the U.S. To Asia, China's experiencing drought. The famous Yangtze River, it's dropped to levels not seen before. In fact, it's so low that three statues of Buddha believed to be over 600 years old have now surfaced. They've completely uncovered. So, and it goes on and on and on and on. You should see the battery of material that I've been following and tracking here. That's just some of it. I've invited Dr. Roy Spencer to join us today to give us a look at what's happening, to better understand the climate. Are we in trouble? Are we reaching a tilting point? Or has this happened in the past and it will happen again, maybe even in the future? Dr. Spencer is a principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. And before that, he was a senior scientist for climate studies at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. And it's good to have him here with us again. Always good to have him. Check him out at drroyspencer.com, drroyspencer.com. It's drroyspencer.com. Good to have you back, doctor. Good afternoon.
Hey, Drew. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much. Well, you know, I got to be honest. I was getting a little bit nervous when I was, you know, every week, every day, you know, certain reports come up. Oh, wow, they found Nazi sunken ships. Oh, wow, they, you know, this shrine, you know, emerged. Oh, wow, they found another body in Lake Mead. And then, you know, as these stories began to compile, I thought, man, it's not just the states. It's globally. And it raises questions for me. Lake Mead is dropping to what many consider dangerously low levels. It hasn't been that low since 1937 and the Hoover Dam when it was first built. Who's to blame? Is it climate change? Is it cyclical? What are we seeing? What's going on?
Well, let's start with the Lake Mead and Hoover Dam situation. Yes, okay. Lake Mead is now at a record low level. And as I blogged about today at drroyspencer.com, if you look at the data, it shows that the main problem is just the increased water use. Yes, the last, you know, 10 years or so have been lower in precipitation, and that's the precipitation that feeds Lake Mead is basically the Colorado Basin watershed, and a lot of that, maybe most of that, comes from snowpack in the Colorado mountains. Okay, well, guess what? The snowpack since you know, the late 1930s, as you mentioned, when Hoover Dam was built, the snowpack hasn't decreased. Though there's no long-term trend downward. So what's going on? Well, if you look at the reports from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation that does detailed studies of the water budget of Lake Mead, you'll see that, and I show that on my blog post today, that water use, you know, what we take out of Lake Mead, which is a man-made reservoir, yep, has increased over the decades steadily, okay? But the water that flows into it naturally, which is mostly from the Colorado River, has basically not changed. Now it was, you know, there was increased flows when we had a bunch of La Nina or El Nino years, late 70s into the 80s. We had some exceptional snowfalls in the Rockies. Okay, so you know, as long as there's a lot more going into Lake Mead than people are taking out, who cares, right?
Right.
And in fact, back then in the late 1980s, the Lake Mead had reached its like maximum. They had to release extra water because it reached its limit, in its upper limit of what it's supposed to hold. And now it's going down again. Well, it's because we've switched into a La Nina pattern. Yeah. In the last 10 years or so, we're getting more La Ninas. Right now, we're in a La Nina. We were in one last year. We're going to be in one next year. And that is on top of increasing human extraction of water from the reservoir. So we have the water levels plummeting, okay? But if you look at the data, the long-term data, it's 90% or more of it is because we got 25 million people in the desert Southwest that like to live where it's sunny every day, mm-hmm, but they need water.
Right, right.
The water's got to come from somewhere. And the water use has just, you know, skyrocketed over the last 60, 70, 80 years in that region. So that's mainly what's going on. But the news reports, of course, tell you, oh, it's long-term climate change. Well, there's really no good evidence that that's occurring yet. We do know what's occurring, and that's that we keep taking more water out of Lake Mead than we should. And it's the water levels are probably going to continue to fall every year because of that.
You know, it's striking to your point about the Southwest. You know, there's a higher demand, population really has grown out there. And my concern is for the ranchers, the farmers, as well as the ordinary people who live in places like Phoenix and other places. They're stab smack in the middle of a desert. Do you think there'll be a reevaluation of you know, moving to deserts to live? And you know, what's it mean for the future of so many of these populations if they continue to have the same demand for water? I mean, how do they remedy that? They do some sort of, you know, some sort of saline treatment to, you know, removing salt from water? Or what do they do to bridge the gap?
Well, there's different options, of course. And, you know, I'm from, my wife and I are originally from the shores of Lake Superior,
Wow, beautiful.
In Michigan. And the, you know, there have been talks from time to time about building a pipeline from Lake Superior to the Green River, which then could feed into Lake Mead. But, you know, and then desalinization. Well, ultimately, it's, you know, water is a scarce resource, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you allow the free market to operate, then, you know, just as water becomes more scarce, it should become more expensive, so that the people that really, you know, can't afford to, or the enterprises or the industries that don't want to spend that much in water, they can move elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, the desert Southwest is not the best choice of a place to live if you need a lot of water. It's just not practical. You know, you can grow crops elsewhere. And in fact, we get a lot of, you know, of our food from other countries imported. And of course, there's a reason that the Corn Belt is in an area that gets naturally enough precip almost every year. So, you know, it's not only a bad choice for, you know, tens of millions of people to live in the desert. It's also a bad choice to try to grow crops there, too. You know, because you're expecting a resource to be right there that is very difficult to deliver.
Right. You spoke about a pipeline from the Great Lakes. I was just talking to somebody about that the other day. How likely is something like that? I mean, if they were to do that, what would happen to lake levels in Superior and Huron and Michigan and Erie and so many of the Great Lakes that we have there? Would water levels drop as they began to take this out? And what would that do to that area? That's the largest body of fresh water in the world.
Yes, the water levels would drop. It might only be, you know, an inch a year, 2 inches a year, 3 inches a year, but that's quite a bit. Now, Great Lakes water levels in recent years have been very high, and they're just now starting to come back down again. There are natural changes, cyclic changes, you know, like you mentioned, a lot of this mm-hmm. stuff, whether it's in the desert Southwest of the U.S. or whether it's in Europe, it's just part of natural cycles that come and go. And, it, you know, all of it's going to change in the future.
Can I just jump in on that point for a second? Now, I'm curious about the narrative we hear where they're talking about climate's warming. You know, we're seeing a 500-year drought in Europe. I'm assuming sea levels are rising because polar ice caps are supposedly melting. Wouldn't that raise the not just the sea level, but the waters in areas like the Great Lakes?
Okay, well, I understand your question. The answer is complicated. As global temperatures rise, which they have, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. It tends to speed up the global hydrologic cycle. That means there's more precipitation on average, but there's also more evaporation because that's the hydrologic cycle. For all that is evaporated from the surface into the atmosphere, it has to return to the surface as precipitation. So the global hydrologic cycle speeds up, all right? Now, what that can mean in specific areas, it's hard to tell. You know, some areas might become drier, some might become wetter. And the climate models that predict these things don't agree amongst themselves about, you know, how that's going to happen. The climate models, for instance, for the desert Southwest of the U.S., on average claim there's going to be about a 10% decrease in rainfall over the next, you know, 50 or 60 years. And there's a huge amount of variation between the climate models in that. And even at that, the models tend to they tend to exaggerate climate change. Those are for the, you know, the most severe scenarios, which we know pretty much for sure are not going to happen. So a lot of this stuff is cyclic. And when people talk about 500-year floods or droughts or 1,000-year floods or droughts, the people that work in hydrology will tell you that's nonsense. There's no such thing as a 500-year drought or a 1,000-year drought, because we don't have data for long enough to tell whether something is a 500 or 1,000-year drought. We have data for maybe 100 years.
So how do we know this stuff is cyclical then? I mean, just for example, I talked about those drought stones. Does geology...
Okay, well, going back to the Western...
Yeah, it's geology.
Well, there have been a number of studies done using tree ring data in the Western U.S., which suggest the last 100 years or so have been unusually wet in the Western U.S., and that in past centuries, over the last 1,000 years, it's actually been drier, and there have been some periods of exceptional drought compared to what we've seen today. Obviously, if those things happen based on the tree ring data, if we believe the tree ring data, if those things happen, then obviously it's some sort of natural cycle. Humans couldn't have been involved in what happened 500 or 1,000 years ago. So clearly there are natural cycles in the climate system, which are probably related, from what we know, it's probably related to deep ocean circulations that which change over very long time scales, centuries, basically, especially in the Western U.S. Western U.S. is very sensitive to what happens out in the Pacific, for instance. So El Niño and La Niña have a big impact on what happens in the Western U.S. Also, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is actually a multi-decadal oscillation, you know, goes 30 years one phase, 30 years in another phase. That, they know, affects precip in the Western U.S., including the Colorado River Basin. They've done studies on this stuff, and it's not insignificant.
Yeah, my guest today, if you want to join us, Dr. Roy Spencer, a very gifted climatologist. The number here, toll-free, 888-914-9149. Doctor, let's talk about the solutions to this. I don't know how long this is going to persist on the West. Water levels are low, as we talked about. I know there are all kinds of programs right now being implemented to reduce carbon emissions. The president just passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which will, of course, go ahead and put billions of dollars into green causes. You know, will that help? I mean, does the planet need to get on board, or do we just need to wait this out?
Well, there's a lot of work that's been done by economists that have looked at this, and I tend to side with those who claim that the best thing to do is to adapt. To the extent that there is any change going on, no matter the cause, whether it's humans or nature, is to adapt, because any attempt to try to fix it is so expensive in terms of human suffering that it's not worth it. I mean, it may sound good to people that are relatively wealthy. Oh, sure, I'll be glad to donate to this whole effort. Yeah, well, most of the world isn't. They're just trying to get by. So I tend to side with those who say that it's better to just adapt to whatever's going on. And,
right.
You know, I've talked to you before about the fact that future climate change now looks like it's going to be much less than what people hear in the media. What people hear in the media tends to be the most extreme scenarios.
True.
Which are now known to be, they're not going to happen. We're not going to have that much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by the end of the century, as the most extreme scenarios are being used to show. And yet those are the ones that make the news, because they're still out there saying, oh, this is how much climate change we could have, changes in storminess, changes in floods, changes in hurricanes, changes in droughts. They're all based on these scenarios, which we now know are not going to happen. There is not going to be that much additional CO2 emitted into the atmosphere. So, you know, climate change isn't going to be as big a problem as we thought, and trying to fix it is extremely expensive. I mean, and expense means in terms of human suffering, not just dollars.
Yeah. That's such a great point. Well, let's grab a call or two. I only have you for a few moments today. I'm grateful for your insight and your expertise. Jim is in Minnesota. Jim, hi, you're on the air with Dr. Spencer. Go right ahead.
Yes. How expensive is it taking ocean water, taking the salt out and making it drinkable? Because there is plenty of water there.
All right. Desalination.
And have you... Yeah.
Well, okay.
And have you ever heard of vertical? Go ahead.
I ever heard of what?
I just got one more question.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim. Why don't you get it in?
Have you ever heard of vertical farming? It started in Wyoming.
Okay, so on the first question, desalinization for to get drinking water, it's very expensive, and it's used to a limited extent, I think, on the west coast of the United States. I'll admit to not being an expert. It does sound like it is an option, but it costs money. It costs extra money. So it's used in places where there's no other practical alternative. I think in the Mideast, you know, where they have lots of oil money, I think they use desalinization of ocean water. but again, it's a cost versus benefit issue. I haven't heard of vertical farming, but I've been working with farming interests in the Middle West, in the Midwest, the Corn Belt states for the last 10 years. And I'm always interested in hearing new ideas about increases in the ability to grow crops.
Yeah, for those who don't know what vertical farming is, and Jim, you can sound off too, it's the practice of growing crops in vertically stacked layers. And it's often done in a controlled environment. And they use hydroponics and aquaponics and aeroponics and all these different things. And there seems to be a lot of success of it. Some are done in buildings, shipping containers, tunnels, abandoned mines. So it could be a possibility. Jim, if you want to give a final thought, feel free to. Otherwise, I'll let you go, okay?
Yeah, they developed them in a seven-story building on trays that are on chains on each side that move real slow up and down. They get water. They get artificial sunlight, and then you could set them up by any city, a bunch of them. You don't need, like California, you say, is lacking water. Well, that's where a lot of our produce comes from. Well, this grows perfect organic produce.
Okay. Hey, Jim, thanks. I'll leave it at that point. Doctor, there you go. A little bit on that. We'll take another call or two. If you want to join us, it's 888-914-9149. Before I go to that, he's talking about alternative means of growing food, right? I saw a report, I think it was earlier this week, and you could probably speak to this. China is talking about seeding clouds, trying to alter the atmosphere to get rain. I don't know where that technology is yet. Are they able to do that to get to have an impact on the atmosphere so certain dry areas will actually get rain? And if so, what are the long-term effects of that?
Okay, this is something that was investigated extensively in the United States back in the 1950s and the 1960s. There were a lot of experiments carried out where they flew planes into clouds and seeded them and tried to do a whole lot of cases in order to get statistically meaningful results. In other words, you can't just fly one plane into a cloud and it rains and say you caused the cloud to rain, because it might have rained anyway. And basically what they found is, if nature isn't ready to make a cloud rain, seeding basically doesn't help. All right?
Yeah.
So I think whatever China is doing is a waste of time, and maybe it's a PR stunt. I don't know. But, yeah, a lot of work was done on that in the U.S., and as a Ph.D. meteorologist, I would say I can see why it would not work. You can't force nature to do that kind of thing that it's not ready to do yet.
All right, that's fascinating to know. Thank God, I guess. I would think that, I think when you alter nature like that, and there's consequences, if it's going to, rain in this, it's got to affect, other areas of the planet as well.
Okay, now I want to clarify, Drew, that that doesn't mean that like our pollution globally doesn't have some impact on precipitation.
Yeah.
For instance, China. Let's take the example of China. Sure. China produces a lot of traditional air pollution emissions, like sulfur dioxide, stuff that we mostly stopped producing over the last 10 or 20 or 30 years. They're still producing a lot of it from a lot of coal-fired power plants. It's entirely possible that on a large scale, that all of those sulfur dioxide emissions, which don't just stay over China, they move out over the Pacific and move towards North America, have some small effect on precipitation. Okay.
All right. That makes sense.
But actually purposely seeding clouds to cause precipitation is probably not going to produce a statistically significant effect.
I got it. Our next call, and I know I have a couple of minutes left here. I have to take a break pretty soon. Diane's in Boston. She's asking about chemtrails, and I'm very curious to see what she's got to say. Diane, good afternoon.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Drew. I spoke with someone once years ago that told me it, you won't see it advertised, but they told me about chemtrails going on. And after I looked up in the sky and they pointed it out, I went online and I could actually find them online. And it's where, you know, you see a plane going by and it's not a typical plane. And you see, instead of like the white exhaust coming out the back and dissipating after a while, it's a big, they're big, long lines that go for a long way, unusual length. And, right. And they don't dissipate for a long time. And they said it's supposed to change the weather patterns and other things. Okay. And other things are falling supposedly from the sky, like aluminum and who knows what.
All right.
So I don't know if does it, you know anything about that.
Let me ask Dr. Spencer to respond because I only got a moment or two left. Doctor, your thoughts on chemtrails? A lot of theory and conspiracy, too, around them. What do you know?
Okay, well, the bottom line is it's I consider that, and virtually everyone in this area considers that to be a conspiracy theory. Yes, jets do produce condensation trails. They put out water vapor as a natural byproduct of combustion of jet fuel. It's been going on for many, many decades. Those clouds that you see up there that are formed, sometimes they persist a long time. Their color is basically going to be the same as other clouds you see in the sky, depending on solar illumination and how high the sun is above the horizon and how many aerosols there are. It's just water vapor. There's no reason to think that we're purposely putting chemicals into the atmosphere from jet engines or from jet aircraft for some nefarious purpose, because if they were doing that, they're hurting the people that are doing it are hurting their relatives as well as the populace.
That's really true. Well, Doctor, I want to thank you. Final thoughts before I take this break, just on what you see happening in the next decade or next even 25 years, if you want. What do you expect temperature-wise, water-wise, for this country and really for the rest of the world?
I think we're going to continue to see a gradual, uneven increase in global average temperatures. There will be very little, if any, change in storminess anywhere. There might be a slow average, globally average increase in precipitation. That would be consistent with a warmer world. I think that the fear of global warming will never go away because for many people it is their religion. It's something they want to believe in. And that's not going to go away. So even if global effects do not, let's say there's no change in the future in global temperatures or in global average storminess, people are still going to latch on to localized flooding, localized droughts that may last for several years and say, oh, this is due to humans. That seems to be an innate human tendency that some people need to believe in.
Doctor, I'm always grateful for your rationality and your clear thought. Thank you for your time. It's so good to have you here. I hope people will follow you at drroyspencer.com. That's drroyspencer.com, drroyspencer.com. Let's catch up again soon. We'll continue to follow this. Grateful, as I said, for you being here.
Okay, thanks, Drew.
God bless you. That's Dr. Roy Spencer, principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. As I said, senior scientist for climate studies at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center prior to that, and an expert in his field. When we come back, we'll talk about possible food shortages.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The WFP has less than half of the money it needs in South Sudan. And Fred reported that some people will actually go hungry at the end of the month if that money doesn't come in. How acute is that problem?
It's a very serious problem, and it's a very serious problem all over the world. And we're facing an unprecedented food crisis globally. South Sudan is no exception to the rule right now. We don't have enough money. The U.S. can't do it alone. The other countries need to step up.
You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, the World Food Program is experiencing funding shortages amid the prospect that a lot of people are going to go hungry without action from the global community. We will see what unfolds. Experts at several companies are sounding the alarm about possible food shortages coming your way. And they say this could lead to political unrest. It could lead to rioting. They said they've seen the pattern before. You know, you just got to look at history. The current situation, political and economic, globally, it could be a dire one. You know, I'm so proud to be an American. I love this country. We as a nation, you know, we comprise, America makes up about 4% of the world's population. And yet we generate a large percentage of the food. So, you know, I think the U.S. will be relatively insulated from this food crisis. But you got to realize what's going on overseas, too. You're talking about a war between Russia and Ukraine. We're talking about 30% of their group. There are 50 countries that rely on Russia and Ukraine for grain, okay? 50 countries, several developing nations, you know, and they're in trouble. We'll see. One example, Turkey imported 78% of its wheat from the two warring countries, and Brazil is the primary market for Russian fertilizer. So what looms in the future? That is a big question. I've invited a very gifted former meteorologist who is now a commodities trader. He monitors this. He's aware of the climate. He's aware of the war. He's aware of all the factors that play into this. Mike McGuire returns today to take your calls and give us a perspective on what we might see in the not-too-distant future regarding, you know, food supply. We talked about the drought out west and the need for water for agriculture. What are we going to see? Mike can be followed, and you can check him out at marketforum.com. Marketforum.com, that's his website. Mr. McGuire, a pleasure to have you back. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much, Drew. It's always a pleasure to talk about topics like this with fellow Catholics.
Amen to that. I love it, too. I'm glad to have you here with me. I just got done speaking with Dr. Roy Spencer, a climatologist, about what we're seeing weather-wise, and I had highlighted the fact, you know, water levels from the Jordan to the Colorado are dropping, like Mead is emptying. He says a lot of it is due to demand, and I worry about agriculture. What do you see coming? There's been a lot of dire warnings that I just shared that there'll be food shortages fundamentally around the world. The U.S. might see some of it. You know, it may not be that we can't eat, but there'll definitely be an increase in the cost of food. How high do you see food prices going right now, and how severe, if any, do you think the problem may be?
I have some great news to share since we last spoke earlier this summer. At the end of July, there were delegations from Ukraine, Turkey, Russia, and the United Nations, and they signed an agreement to allow for the safe passage of grains from three different Ukrainian ports. So immediately after that happened, the USDA increased its estimate from Ukraine for corn exports by 3.5 million tons, and they boosted their wheat exports up to a million more tons than what we thought was going to happen a couple of months ago. And in addition to that, the best news is that the Northern Hemisphere has been blessed with some wonderful growing season weather. I know you hear about the droughts, there's five different countries that have increased their production. These higher prices also resulted in more planting because that's what higher prices do. It becomes more profitable. But China, India, Canada, Australia, and Russia are all expected to have bigger crops coming this fall, and as a result, the U.S. United Nations increased their production by 7 million tons from June to July. So that it now equates to almost what the record in 2020 was for production and exports, just 0.5% less than that. The food is going to be there now. You can't predict what's going to happen in Ukraine. No. Something could change that. But the problem is the food is still going to be high priced, and poor countries are going to have a hard time affording that. And the high food prices are going to continue as long as fertilizer prices remain three times higher than they have been historically, in fact, compared to just 2 years ago.
So, high fertilizer costs, one of the big, big factors in what we might see. A couple things, and I'm going to take a few calls for you, too. If you want to join us, it's 888-914-9149. Climate change, you know, that's being blamed for the drought that's extended from our own country across the globe to Europe and China. Your take on that? I mean, I spoke to Dr. Roy Spencer. If it continues, I think it's certainly affect the food supply here. But your thoughts? How real is that? Are we in a cycle? What do you see happening here?
I believe the drought is strongly correlated with the La Nina, which has been there. This is the third mm-hmm. year of the La Nina, and all our previous major droughts correlate with La Niñas, the 2012 drought in the Midwest, the 1988 drought. But a La Niña is cool temperatures in the tropical Pacific. So that's not from global warming or climate change. That's a weather phenomenon. It's temporary. And the fact is, and I'm sure Dr. Spencer mentioned this, is that climate change has not featured an increase in global drought. We hear about it all the time. We hear about the extremes, and everything is blamed, including snow and cold, on climate change. But the fact is, the growing conditions for the last 30 years have been the best on this planet since 1,000 years ago in the medieval warm period, which had warmth similar to this. So climate change gets a lot of blame, but actually it should be getting more credit because it's brought beneficial weather. And the biggest bonus has been carbon dioxide, which is a beneficial gas, and they haven't repealed the law of photosynthesis. The more you increase carbon dioxide, the bigger the yields increase. We've gone from 300 parts per million to 420 parts per million, which is an increase of 120 since 100 years ago. So for every 5% you increase the carbon dioxide, you increase crop yields and crop growth by 1%. So 120 parts per million, I hope you're following the math, equates to a 24% increase in crop yields just from the increase in carbon dioxide. So
I was going to say, don't go too deep. I can hear the radios clicking off right now. I don't get this. You get it, intimately, and I understand how that all plays out. Let's take a call or two for you, too, if we could, Mike.
Sure.
Deborah is listening in Wisconsin. Deborah, good afternoon.
Hi, Deborah.
Good afternoon. My question is, as you talk about the increased production of crop yields, and I'm wondering exactly what crops those are. Where I live, the primary crops aren't grown for human consumption. A lot of corn is grown for ethanol and to feed cows, or soybeans that are genetically modified. So I'd like you to address that, if you would, please.
All right.
Sure. There's a number of crops: soybeans, corn, wheat. I know most of the corn is feed corn, which goes to feed animals, but and there's soybean meal too. But there's oats, rice, barley, rye, millet, sorghum. There's all those crops benefit from the increase in carbon dioxide. Are those the crops you were interested in, Deborah?
She's still there. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Just which crops for human consumption are being increased? You said there is a production increase in certain yields, and I'm wondering what crops would be.
Well, we've done thousands of experiments and studies on all crops, and some of the ones that are notable are the wheat crop. We use a lot of wheat, rice, plenty of rice. There's a lot of barley and rye and sorghum used for human consumption.
All right. I got to hold it right there. Deborah, thanks for your call. I've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take a few more of your calls. I only have a few moments left. Joined today by Mike McGuire, commodity trader, former meteorologist, and you can check him out at marketforum.com. We're taking a look at reports that are coming on possible food shortages. If you're just tuning in, I'll bring you up to speed on what's being reported. We'll take your calls and questions, and we'll continue our conversation right after this. Stay with us.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Get a 360-degree look at all the news and issues of the day right now. This is the Drew Mariani Show, getting you connected on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, a little Hootie and the Blowfish. That's a classic album. Good to have you with me today. I am just delighted to hang out with you. Taking a broad view of what's happening in the planet, from talking with Dr. Roy Spencer, a noted climatologist, to a former meteorologist, now commodity trader, Mike McGuire, about the possible food shortage coming. I've been seeing some reports on this. I don't know how true it is. I thought we'd at least explore it together. With this war in Ukraine hitting the breadbasket of Europe, there are all kinds of predictions about food shortages. And Mike says, they've signed this compact or this deal. I hope so. I hope we do not see this. I saw a report from the United Nations where the number of people that are acutely hungry has dramatically accelerated since the beginning of COVID-19. Just to give you some numbers, I don't want to give you too many numbers. I know sometimes it can be, it's hard to digest. 135 million people faced acute food insecurity before the pandemic. You know what the number is today? 276 million over the last 2 years. So the World Food Program's chief economist there says this is a story that's going from bad to worse. And he said that 50 million people across 45 countries are already on the verge of famine. Another 345 million are approaching starvation across more than 80 countries. So it raises questions. What are we to do? How do we help our brothers? And then secondly, what does it mean for the United States of America? What's it going to mean for you? Will your food prices go up as a result of this? Part of the problem's been drought. It's been war. But also the availability of fertilizer is, as Mike was pointing out, fertilizer is dependent on petroleum. And with the U.S. cutting off its supply, its production, and the Ukraine war disrupting Russian supplies to Europe, fertilizer production has just been cut back. Prices are through the roof. And there are some countries that have been just trying to cut back to, if not totally eliminate, artificial fertilizer. But there's a lot at play. We'll see how it all shakes out. Mike, I'm so glad to have you with me. I want you to expand on that for a moment, because we could talk climate change, we can talk whether or not the wheat's going to grow, but I think at the heart of this, and this affects countries all over the world, we're seeing massive potential for famine, and then we have this fertilizer crisis on top of that. Two little bit different things, but the role of fertilizer and when we're going to get that back up to where it should be, and how serious this famine is. Mike, you with us? I think I might have lost Mike. All right, so we'll try to reconnect with him. Mike, I think we lost your signal. I'm not hearing him in my headsets here. So just to follow up on that point here, just just on the fertilizer, you've got countries like Sri Lanka, you've got the Netherlands, you've got European countries. If they could eliminate them, they would. Artificial fertilizers have caused serious problems in how much the land is yielding. So you kind of need this stuff. All this means, in the end, that food prices, you will see an increase. You already see it when you go to the grocery stores. How much is a pack of chicken, right? How much is a gallon of milk, whole milk, let's say, or your eggs? Have they gone up? How about your produce? How about meat? We're the United States of America. We are a land of abundance. What's happening in other countries around the world, that price increase, most people can't absorb it. I saw an interview with one woman who made that case. She came out and said, I've got to pick and choose what I buy, and I got to buy the lesser product, and sometimes it's filled with things that aren't the healthiest choice. So we're certainly seeing the ripple effects of this. All right, Maggie, we'll see if we can get Mike back, but if we don't, that's okay. Let me take a quick call or two. We'll go to Denver, Colorado. Dan, good afternoon.
Hey, Drew, how are you? Dan in Colorado. I want to make a few statements. One, you keep calling Mike a former meteorologist, but I'm a meteorologist. And there's no such thing as a former meteorologist. We're weather geeks, brother. We're there long term.
You're like Marines, right? Once a Marine, always a Marine. Once a meteorologist, always a meteorologist.
I'll bet you Mike's got 15 weather apps on his phone just like I do.
That is so funny.
One thing, whenever I hear discussions like this and food hunger is the thing that the Holy Spirit moves my heart on. You know, I always wonder, what can I do right now? These global numbers are astronomical, but here in Colorado, we know that 1 in 7 children go hungry every night. Amazing. Wow. How can this be? This is America. You called it a land of abundance, right?
Yeah,
1 in 7. So I'll challenge Catholics, hey, that local food bank that when they have that food drive, that's great. You could bring a can of beans or two or three. Send them money because they can buy in bulk. And that's how they really work these food banks. So please support your local food bank. Amazing. Colorado, 1 in 7. And by the way, a real quick final statement.
Yeah.
You came up with the UN statistic, and I thought, wow, the UN's doing something good. I never do that.
it's such a juxtaposition of what I talked about in the beginning of the show today regarding the UN. Hey, Dan, first of all, thank you. Let me get your take before I let you go, because you are a meteorologist. You're seeing the Colorado River, right? You've seen so many of the things I've been talking about here for the past hour.
Absolutely.
What's your take on this? What's your big view in terms of where we're heading with our water supply and just temperatures in general and what it portends for the future?
Well, I'm gonna go right along with Mike because I believe what he says. On my ride home from work, I pass several reservoirs and I see a lot of mud. And we've been blessed for the last month with a good amount of monsoon rain, and we could use it, but we have to have it in the right place. We need our mountaintops to get white during the winter, and we're not so white in the winter. But yeah. I agree with him with this global phenomena of La Niña, El Niño. These are things we have to pay attention to. But all we hear on the news reports is what those folks want us to hear, and we all know that they're not really telling the truth on everything.
They say
follow the science. They say follow the science. Well, except if the science doesn't agree with what you want.
That is so true. Hey, Dan, I'm glad you found the show, and I'm glad you called in. Feel free to do it again. I appreciate your perspective.
Right. But
I stand corrected. Once a meteorologist, always a meteorologist, right?
Yeah, you got to stop that former meteorologist.
I love it. He's a commodity trader now, so I'm using his talents to read the market.
And he's got 15 weather apps on his phone, I guarantee
it. I love it. Well, thanks, Mike. Good to hear from you. I appreciate the call.
Mike,
and my apologies, too, because we had a technical issue with Mike McGuire, our meteorologist and commodity trader. He happened to get disconnected during our conversation, but I appreciate Dan's call, too. I just want to follow up on what Dan said just momentarily, if I could. He's so right. Gosh, if you want to make a difference, I call this country a land of abundance. We are blessed from sea to shining sea. It's a stunning fact that 1 in 7 are going to go hungry, and that's Colorado. I don't know what it's like down south or in other parts of the nation, even West Virginia, maybe a little bit more impoverished areas of our country. If you've been blessed, I believe so deeply in giving. First, let's pray for our country. Let's pray for rain. Let's pray for prosperity. Let's pray for God's mercy. Let's pray against the great evils that are being promoted and promulgated in our country, that God will hold back his hand of justice, shower us with his mercy, and bless our land, bless our people, right? But also do your part. You know, the Lord doesn't need our money. He needs you to step out and to make a difference. If there's a food shelter in your area, check your local parish, check your local community. Support. No one in America should ever go hungry. No one should ever go hungry. As I said, we're 4% of the world's population, and yet we produce massive amounts of food in this country. This is, you know, there's not a greater nation on the planet to live than the United States of America. Dan, thank you for your call. I do appreciate it. Before I wrap it up, I want to just put a quick plug in for On the Night Train. Now, you probably have heard a few promos about this. Peter Atkinson is going to join me tomorrow. He's the creator behind this, kind of the genius that's doing this production. And, you know, we live in a time where we're inundated with smartphones, right, and our televisions and our computers and our laptops, and we don't spend a whole lot of time together as a family. What Relevant Radio has done with its entertainment division, the Merry Beggars, they're going to debut a new audio drama. It's coming out in September. It's called On the Night Train. And I'll play some audio for you tomorrow. You get to hear it. And it is a it's a mystery. You're going to love this audio mystery. It's something for all the families. Maybe, you know, sit down, sign up, subscribe for it, first of all. And then maybe have the family. See, tonight we're going to gather together, put it on the radio. If you don't have family, you're saying, well, I don't really want to do that. My kids will never do that. Then you know what? Listen to it when you take your walk or you take your drive to work. You know, you listen to podcasts, perhaps, maybe even listen to the show. This would be both entertaining and I think incredibly edifying. It's off the charts in terms of the production, and I just think it's good. It's Relevant Radio's way of helping to change the culture, to bring the good, the true, and the beautiful back to a society that's overwhelmed with such darkness and negativity, such discord. And we want to pierce the cacophony of that discord with something that is good and beautiful. And I think this is that. I'm out of time for the day. Thanks for being with me. Always good to hang out with you. Pray for me. I will pray for you. I promise you that. All right. Looking forward to tomorrow. We've got a great program. In fact, the Big Bang Theory, you know, this James Webb's telescope, it may raise questions about whether or not the Big Bang actually happened. And the universe, some say, might be younger than we believed. I'll fill you in on that and a whole lot more.